rushed back to headquarters and reported, "We've got a spy in our sector." Before an arrest party was dispatched, further inquiries revealed that the man was none other than Winston Churchill, who had volunteered to command a battalion on the Western Front after being forced to resign as First Lord of the Admiralty in the wake of the disastrous invasion of Gallipoli. While visiting the trenches south of Fawcett's position, Churchill wrote, "Filth and rubbish everywhere. Graves built into the defenses and scattered about promiscuously, feet and clothing breaking through the soil, water and muck on all sides, and about this scene in the dazzling moonlight, troops of enormous bats creep and glide, to the unceasing accompaniment of rifles and machine guns, and the venomous whining and whirring of the bullets which pass overhead." Fawcett, who was accustomed to inhuman conditions, was superb at holding his position, and in January 1916, he was promoted to lieutenant colonel and put in command of a brigade of more than 700 men. Nina kept Kelty and the Royal Geographical Society apprised of his activities. In a letter dated March 2, 1916, she wrote, "He is very well in spite of 3 months constantly under shellfire." Several weeks later, she said that he was overseeing 9 batteries, far more than constituted a typical brigade. "So you can imagine how hard worked he is," she said, adding, "Of course, I am glad he has an opportunity to use his powers of organization and leadership, for it all helps in the struggle for victory." Nina was not the only one who touted his abilities. He was repeatedly cited in dispatches for his gallant and distinguished services under fire. Even in the trenches, Fawcett tried to keep informed of events in the Amazon. He learned of expeditions being led by anthropologists and explorers from America, which was not yet engaged in the war, and these reports only intensified his fear that someone would discover Z before he did. In a letter to his old teaching mentor, Reeves, he confided, "If you only knew what these expeditions cost in physical strain, you would, I feel sure, appreciate what a lot it means to me that I shall have the completion of the work." He had reason to fret, in particular, about Dr. Rice. To Fawcett's shock, the RGS had, in 1914, presented Dr. Rice with a gold medal for his meritorious work on the headwaters of the Orinoco and the northern tributaries of the Amazon. Fawcett was incensed that his own efforts had not received equal recognition. Then, in early 1916, he discovered that the doctor was preparing to launch another expedition. A bulletin in the Geographical Journal announced that our medalist, Dr. Rice, would ascend the Amazon and the Rio Negro with a view to still further extending our knowledge of the region previously explored by him. Why was the doctor returning to the same area? The bulletin said little more than that Dr. Rice was building a 40-foot motor-powered vessel that could navigate through swamps and carry 700 gallons of petrol. It must have cost a fortune, though what did that matter to a millionaire? That spring, amid intense fighting, Fawcett received a letter from the Royal Geographical Society. It said that, in tribute to his historic mapping of South America, he, too, had been awarded a gold medal. The Society gave out 2 gold medals, both equal in prestige. Fawcett's was the founder's medal, and Dr. Rice's the patron's. The award was the same honor that had been bestowed upon the likes of Livingston and Burton. The dream of his life, as Nina put it. Not even the prospect of Dr. Rice's expedition or the continuation of the war could diminish Fawcett's delight. Nina, who told Kelty that such an occasion comes only once in a lifetime, quickly set about planning for the award presentation on May 22. Fawcett obtained leave to attend. "I possess the medal and am content," he remarked. After the ceremony, he hurried back to the front. He had received orders that the British command was launching an unprecedented assault with the aim of ending the war. In early July 1916, Fawcett and his men took up their positions along a placid river in northern France, providing cover as tens of thousands of British soldiers clambered up ladders propped against the muddy trench walls and marched onto the battlefield, bayonets gleaming and arms swinging, like in a parade. From his perch, Fawcett would have seen the German gunners, who were supposed to have been destroyed by weeks of bombardment. They were emerging from cavernous holes, unleashing machine gun fire. The British soldiers fell, one by one. Fawcett tried to offer cover, but there was no way to protect men walking into a hail of bullets and 18-pound shells and liquidy bursts from flamethrowers. No force of nature in the jungle had prepared him for this man-made onslaught. Bits of letters and photographs that men had carried into battle fluttered over their corpses like snow. The wounded crawled into shell holes, shrieking. Fawcett called it Armageddon. It was the Battle of the Somme, or what the Germans, who suffered massive casualties as well, referred to in letters home as the Bath of Blood. On the first day of the offensive, nearly 20,000 British soldiers died and almost 40,000 were wounded. It was the greatest loss of life in the history of the British military, and many in the West began to portray the savage as European rather than as some native in the jungle. Fawcett, quoting a companion, wrote that cannibalism at least provides a reasonable motive for killing a man, which is more than you can say for civilized warfare. When Ernest Shackleton, who had been trekking through Antarctica for nearly a year and a half, emerged in 1916 on the island of South Georgia, he immediately asked someone, "Tell me, when was the war over?" The person replied, "The war is not over. Europe is mad. The whole world is mad." As the conflict dragged on, Fawcett often remained at the front lines, living among corpses. The air smelled of blood and fumes. Trenches became bogs of urine and excrement and bones and lice and maggots and rats. The walls caved in from rain, and occasionally men drowned in the slime. One soldier sank slowly for days in a mud hole without anyone being able to reach him. Fawcett, who had always found a refuge in the natural world, no longer recognized the wilderness of bombed-out villages, denuded trees, craters, and sun-baked skeletons. As Lyne wrote in his diary, Dante would never have condemned lost souls to wander in so terrible a purgatory. Periodically, Fawcett would hear a gong-like sound, which meant the gases were coming. Shells unleashed phosgene, chlorine, or mustard gas. A nurse described patients burnt up and blistered all over with great mustard-colored suppurating blisters, with blind eyes, all sticky and stuck together, and always fighting for breath, with voices a mere whisper, saying that their throats are closing and they know they will choke. In March 1917, Nina sent a letter to the RGS saying her husband had been gassed after Christmas. For once, Fawcett had been injured. He was troubled for some time by the effects of the poison, Nina told Kelty. Certain days were worse than others. He feels better, but not quite right. All around Fawcett, people he knew or had been associated with were dying. The war had claimed the lives of more than 130 RGS members. Conan Doyle's oldest son, Kingsley, died of wounds and influenza. A surveyor with whom Fawcett had worked on the South American Boundary Commission was killed. "He was a good fellow. We all thought so," Fawcett informed Kelty. "I am sorry." A friend in his brigade was blown up when he rushed to help someone, an act, Fawcett wrote in his official report, of purely unselfish self-sacrifice. Toward the end of the war, Fawcett described some of the carnage that he had witnessed in a missive published in an English newspaper under the headline, "British Colonel in Letter Here Tells of Enormous Slaughter." If you can imagine 60 miles of front, to a depth of 1 to 30 miles, literally carpeted with dead, often in little hills, Fawcett wrote, "it is a measure of the price paid. Masses of men moved to the slaughter in endless waves, bridged the wires and filled the trenches with dead and dying. It was the irresistible force of an army of ants, where the pressure of the succeeding waves forced the legions in front, willingly or unwillingly, into the shambles. No thin line could withstand the human tidal wave or go on killing forever. It is, I think, the most terrible testimony to the relentless effect of an unbridled militarism. He concluded, "Civilization, ye gods, to see what one has seen, the word is an absurdity. It has been an insane explosion of the lowest human emotions." Amid this onslaught, Fawcett continued to be heralded in dispatches for his bravery, and as the London Gazette announced on January 4, 1917, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Order Medal. But if his body remained intact, his mind appeared, at times, to be wavering. When he visited home on leave, he often sat for hours without speaking, holding his head in his hands. He sought solace in spiritualism and occult rituals that offered a way to communicate with missing loved ones, a refuge that many Europeans turned to in their grief. Conan Doyle described attending a séance where he heard a voice. "I said, 'Is that you, boy?' He said in a very intense whisper and a tone all his own, 'Father,' and then after a pause, 'Forgive me.' I said, 'There was never anything to forgive. You were the best son a man ever had.' A strong hand descended on my head, which was slowly pressed forward, and I felt a kiss just above my brow. 'Are you happy?' I cried. There was a pause, and then very gently, 'I am so happy.'" Fawcett wrote to Conan Doyle about his own experiences with mediums. He recounted how his dreaded mother had spoken to him during a séance. The medium who channeled her spirit said, "She loved you so as a little boy, and she has remorse for treating you badly. And she would like to send her love, but fears it might not be accepted." In the past, Fawcett's interest in the occult had been largely an expression of his youthful rebellion and scientific curiosity, and had contributed to his willingness to defy the prevailing orthodoxies of his own society and to respect tribal legends and religions. Now, though, his approach was untethered from his rigorous RGS training and acute powers of observation. He imbibed Madame Blavatsky's most outlandish teachings about Hyperboreans and astral bodies and lords of the dark face and keys to unlocking the universe, the other world seemingly more tantalizing than the present one. In The Land of Mist, Conan Doyle's 1926 sequel to The Lost World, John Roxton, the character said to be partly based on Fawcett, embraces spiritualism and investigates the existence of ghosts. There was a rumor among some officers that Fawcett used a Ouija board, a popular tool of mediums, to help make tactical decisions on the battlefield. He and his intelligence officer would retire to a darkened room and put their four hands, but not their elbows, on the board. Henry Harold Hemming, who was then a captain in Fawcett's corps, wrote in an unpublished memoir. Fawcett would then ask the Ouija board in a loud voice if this was a confirmed location of the enemy's position, and if the miserable board skidded over in the right direction, not merely would he include it in his list of confirmed locations, but often order 20 rounds of 9.2 howitzer to be fired at the place. More than anything, though, Fawcett was consumed with visions of Z, which, amid the war's horror, gathered only more luster, a glittering place seemingly immune to the rottenness of Western civilization. Or, as he told Conan Doyle, something of the lost world really did exist. By all accounts, Fawcett thought about Z when he was firing howitzers, when he was being shot at in the trenches, when he was burying the dead. In an article published in the Washington Post in 1934, a soldier in Fawcett's unit recalled how, many times in France, when the commander was marking time between raids and attacks, he would tell of his explorations and adventures in South American jungles, of the heavy rains and the thick tangle of grass and bushes meeting overhanging vines and branches, and the deep, unbroken quiet of the interior. An officer from his brigade wrote in a letter that Fawcett was already full of the hidden cities and treasures he intended to search for. Fawcett deluged Costin and Manley, who were also fighting on the Western Front, with letters, trying to secure their services in the future. and he petitioned the RGS for funding. It is a little awkward, as you can understand, for us at the present moment to make any definite promise as to what could be done after the war, Kelty responded to one of his appeals. If you can only afford to wait. I am getting older and am, I dare say, impatient of lost years and months, Fawcett complained to Kelty in early 1918. Later that year, he told Travel magazine, knowing what these journeys in the real fastness of the forest mean to men a good deal younger than I am, I do not want to delay action. On June 28, 1919, nearly 5 years after Fawcett returned from the Amazon and shortly before his 52nd birthday, Germany finally signed a peace treaty and surrender. Some 20 million people had been killed and at least 20 million wounded. Fawcett described the whole business as suicide for Western civilization and thought many thousands must have come through those 4 years of mud and blood with a similar disillusionment. Returning to his home in England, he saw his wife and children on a regular basis for the first time in years. He was astonished by how much Jack had grown, how much bigger he was through his shoulders and around his arms. Jack had recently celebrated his 16th birthday and was now quite an inch, if not more, taller than his father, Nina wrote in a letter to Harold Large, a family friend who lived in New Zealand. Jack had developed into a powerful athlete and was already honing his body for the day when he was old enough to venture with his father into the wilderness. We all went to the sports on Saturday and saw him win the second prize for the high jump and putting the weight, Nina said. Fawcett and Jack played their usual sports together, only now the son often surpassed the father in ability. Jack wrote to Large, boasting, I had a ripping cricket season, as I was vice-captain of the school team and won the average ball and was second in the batting averages. Also, I never dropped a catch throughout the whole season. He wrote with a mixture of youthful cockiness and innocence. He noted that he had taken up photography and made some ripping photos. Occasionally in his letters, he'd include a pen and ink caricature of his brother or sister. Despite his brashness and athletic grace, Jack remained in many ways an awkward teenager who, unsure how to interact with girls and desperate to uphold his father's monkish edicts, seemed mostly at ease in the company of his childhood friend, Raleigh Rimmel. Brian Fawcett said that Raleigh was Jack's able and willing lieutenant. During the war, the two friends would shoot starlings off the roofs of surrounding houses, causing a furor among the neighbors and the local police. Once, Raleigh shattered a letterbox and was summoned by the police and ordered to pay 10 shillings to replace it. Whenever Raleigh passed the new letterbox, he would polish it with a handkerchief and proclaim, "This is mine, you know." On the rare occasions when Raleigh wasn't present, it was Brian Fawcett who followed Jack around. Brian was different from his older brother, indeed different from most Fawcett men. He lacked athletic prowess and was often, as he admitted, bullied by other kids into a stupor. Suffering in the shadow of his brother, Brian recalled, at school it was always Jack who distinguished himself in games, in fights, and by standing up to the severe canings of the headmaster. Although Nina thought her children had no hidden feeling of fear or distrust toward their parents, Brian seemed roiled by his father's actions. Fawcett always seemed to want to play with Jack and touted him as a future explorer. He even gave Jack his Ceylon treasure map. Brian once noted in a letter to his mother that at least when his father was away, there were no favorites in the house. One day, Brian followed Jack into the room where their father kept his collection of artifacts. It included a sword, stone axes, a spear tipped with bone, bows and arrows, and shell necklaces. The boys had previously devoured a bag of nuts that the chief of the Mashubis had given Fawcett as a present. Now Jack removed a beautifully handcrafted musket called a jezail, which Fawcett had obtained in Morocco. Wondering if it would fire, Jack carried the jezail outside and loaded it with powder. Given its rust and age, the gun was likely to backfire, lethally, and Jack said that he and Brian should flip a coin to see who would pull the trigger. Brian lost. My elder brother stood well clear and goaded me on to fulfill my honorable obligation to risk suicide, Brian recalled. I pulled the trigger, the pan flashed and sizzled, and nothing further seemed to happen. But things were happening. An appreciable time after pulling the trigger, there was a loud, asthmatic sort of cough and a huge cloud of red dust vomited out of the muzzle. The gun didn't fire, but Brian had demonstrated, at least for an instant, that he was as daring as his older brother. Fawcett, meanwhile, was frantically trying to organize what he called his Path to Z. His two most trusted companions were no longer available. Manley had died of heart disease shortly after the war, and Costin had married and decided to settle down. The loss of these men was a blow that perhaps only Costin fully appreciated. He told his family that Fawcett's only Achilles heel as an explorer was that he hated to slow down, and he needed someone whom he trusted enough to defer to when the person said, "Enough." Without him or Manley, Costin feared, there would be no one to stop Fawcett. Fawcett then suffered a more severe setback. The RGS and a number of other institutions turned down his requests for funding. The war had made money for scientific exploration harder to come by, but that wasn't the only reason. University-trained anthropologists and archaeologists were displacing Hints to Travelers amateurs. Subspecialization had rendered obsolete the man or woman who dared to try to provide an autopsies of the entire Earth. Another South American explorer and contemporary of Fawcett's complained bitterly that the general practitioner in this everyday world of ours is being squeezed out. And although Fawcett remained a legend, most of the new specialists disputed his theory of Z. "I cannot induce scientific men to accept even the supposition that there are traces of an old civilization in the Amazon," Fawcett wrote in his journals. Colleagues had once doubted his theory of Z largely for biological reasons. The Indians were physically incapable of constructing a complex civilization. Now, many of the new breed of scientists doubted him for environmental reasons. The physical landscape of the Amazon was too inhospitable for primitive tribes to construct any sort of sophisticated society. Biological determinism had increasingly given way to environmental determinism. And the Amazon, the great counterfeit paradise, was the most vivid proof of the Malthusian limits that the environment placed on civilizations. The chronicles of the early El Dorado hunters that Fawcett cited only confirmed to many in the scientific establishment that he was an amateur. An article in Geographical Review concluded that the Amazon basin was so bereft of humankind that it was like one of the world's great deserts, comparable with the Sahara. The distinguished Swedish anthropologist Erland Nordenskjold, who had met Fawcett in Bolivia, acknowledged that the English explorer was an extremely original man, absolutely fearless, but that he suffered from boundless imagination. An official at the RGS said of Fawcett, "He is a visionary kind of man who sometimes talks rather nonsense," and added, "I do not expect that his going in for spiritualism has improved his judgment." Fawcett protested to Kelty, "Remember that I am a sane enthusiast and not an eccentric hunter of the snark," a reference to the make-believe creature in the Lewis Carroll poem. According to the poem, snark hunters often suddenly vanish away and never be met with again. Within the RGS, Fawcett maintained a loyal faction of supporters, including Reeves and Kelty, who in 1921 became the Society's vice president. "Never mind what people say about you and about your so-called tall stories," Kelty told Fawcett. "That does not matter. There are plenty of people who believe in you." Fawcett might have persuaded his detractors with delicacy and tact, but after so many years in the jungle, he had become a creature of it. He did not dress fashionably, and in his house preferred to sleep in a hammock. His eyes were sunk deep in their sockets, like a doomsday prophet's, and even among the eccentrics at the RGS, there was something vaguely frightening about what one official called his rather queer manner. After reports circulated within the society that he was too intemperate, too uncontrollable, Fawcett grumbled to members of its council, "I don't lose my temper. I am not naturally tempestuous, though his protestation suggested that he was being thrown into yet another peak. In 1920, following the New Year, Fawcett used what little savings he had to move his family to Jamaica, saying that he wanted his children to have an opportunity to grow up in the virile ambiente of the New World. Although 16-year-old Jack had to leave school, he was delighted because Raleigh Rimmel had also settled there with his family after the death of his father. While Jack worked as a cowhand on a ranch, Raleigh toiled on a United Fruit Company plantation. At night, the two boys would often get together and plot their incandescent futures, how they would dig up the Gala Pita Gala treasure in Ceylon and crawl through the Amazon in search of Z. That February, Fawcett left again for South America in the hope of securing funding from the Brazilian government. Dr. Rice, whose 1916 journey had ended prematurely owing to the entry of the United States into the war, was already back in the jungle near the Orinoco, a region north of the one Fawcett had targeted, which for centuries had been speculated to be a possible location of El Dorado. As usual, Dr. Rice went with a large, well-armed party, which rarely veered far from the major rivers. Ever obsessed with gadgetry, he had designed a 45-foot boat to overcome, as he put it, the difficulty of bad rapids, strong currents, submerged rocks, and shallow waters. The boat was shipped in pieces to Manaus, just as the city's opera house had been, and was assembled by laborers working around the clock. Dr. Rice christened the boat Eleanor II for his wife, who accompanied him on a less risky leg of the journey. He had also brought along a mysterious 40-pound black box with dials and with wires jutting from it. Vowing that it would transform exploration, he had loaded the contraption into his boat and taken it with him into the jungle. One evening at camp, he carefully removed the box and placed it on a makeshift table. Slipping on a pair of earphones and twirling the dials as ants crawled over his fingertips, he could hear vague crackling sounds as if someone were whispering from behind the trees, only the signals were coming from as far as the United States. Dr. Rice had picked them up using a wireless telegraphy set, an early radio, specially outfitted for the expedition. The device cost around $6,000, the equivalent today of about $67,000. Each night, as the rain dripped off the leaves and monkeys swung over his head, Dr. Rice would set up the machine and listen to the news, how President Woodrow Wilson had suffered a stroke, and how the Yankees had purchased Babe Ruth from the Red Sox for $125,000. Although the machine could not send messages, it retrieved signals indicating the time of day at different meridians around the globe, so that Dr. Rice could more accurately fix longitude. The results far exceeded expectations, remarked John W. Swanson, a member of the expedition who helped operate the radio. Time signals were received at every locality where they were desired, and a daily newspaper, published from news reports received from radio stations in the United States, Panama, and Europe, kept the members of the expedition fully informed of current events. The expedition followed the Cassiquiare, a 200-mile natural canal that connected the Orinoco and the Amazon river systems. At one point, Dr. Rice and his men abandoned the boats and went on foot to explore a portion of jungle that was rumored to contain Indian artifacts. After cutting through the forest for about half a mile, they came upon several towering rocks and curious markings. The men quickly scraped away the moss and vines. The rock faces were painted with figures resembling animals and human bodies. Without more modern technology, radiocarbon dating wasn't available until 1949, it was impossible to determine their age, but they were similar to the ancient-looking rock paintings that Fawcett had seen and made diagrams of in his logbooks. The expedition, excited, returned to the boat and continued to ascend the river. On January 22, 1920, two members of Dr. Rice's team were foraging along the shore when they thought they saw someone watching them. They bolted back to camp, sounding the alarm. In an instant, Indians fanned out on the opposite bank of the river. A large, stout, dark, hideous individual gesticulated violently, and kept shouting in an angry manner, Dr. Rice later wrote in his report to the RGS. A thick, short growth of hair adorned his upper lip, and a great tooth was suspended from the lower. He was the leader of a band of which some 60 were visible at first, but more seemed to spring up each minute until the bank was lined with them as far up and down as we could see. They carried longbows, arrows, clubs, and blow darts. What was most striking, however, was their skin. It was almost white in color, Dr. Rice said. The tribesmen were Yanomami, one of the groups of so-called white Indians. During his previous expeditions, Dr. Rice had taken a cautious, paternalistic approach when contacting tribes. Whereas Fawcett believed that the Indians should, for the most part, remain uncontaminated by Westerners, Dr. Rice thought that they should be civilized, and he and his wife had established a school in São Gabriel along the Rio Negro, and several medical clinics staffed with Christian missionaries. After one visit to the school, Dr. Rice told the RGS that the change in the children's dress, manners, and general appearance, and the atmosphere of order and industry were in striking contrast to the squalid village of naked little savages that had once prevailed. Now, as the Yanomami approached, Dr. Rice's men stood watch, armed with an assortment of weapons, including a rifle, a shotgun, a revolver, and a muzzleloader. Dr. Rice placed offerings of knives and mirrors on the ground, where the light could glint off them. The Indians, perhaps seeing the guns aimed at them, refused to take the gifts. Instead, some Yanomami edged closer to the explorers, pointing their drawn bows. Dr. Rice ordered his men to fire a warning shot over their heads, but the gesture only provoked the Indians, who began to unleash their arrows, one landing by the doctor's foot. Dr. Rice then gave the command to open fire, shooting to kill. It is not known how many Indians died during the onslaught. In a missive to the RGS, Dr. Rice wrote, "There was no alternative, they being the aggressors, resenting all attempts at parley or truce, and compelling a defensive that resulted disastrously for them and was a keen disappointment to me." As the Indians retreated under the fusillade, Dr. Rice and his men returned to their boats and fled. "We could hear their blood-curdling screams as they kept at our heels," Dr. Rice said. When the expedition eventually emerged from the jungle, the explorers were hailed for their bravery. Fawcett, however, was appalled and told the RGS that to shoot indiscriminately at the Indians was reprehensible. He also could not resist pointing out that Dr. Rice had skedaddled the moment he encountered danger and was rather too soft for the real game. Yet reports that the doctor had uncovered ancient Indian paintings and intended to head back into the jungle with even more gadgetry put Fawcett in a frenzy as he tried to raise funding in Brazil. In Rio, he stayed with the British ambassador, Sir Ralph Paget, a close friend who lobbied the Brazilian government on his behalf. Although the RGS had refused to devote its depleted resources to the expedition, it recommended its famous disciple to the Brazilian government, writing in a cable that, "It is quite true that he has a reputation of being difficult to get on with, but all the same, he has an extraordinary power of getting through difficulties that would deter anybody else." On February 26, a meeting was arranged with the Brazilian president, Epitácio Pessoa, and the renowned explorer and head of the Indian Protection Service, Cândido Rondon. Fawcett presented himself as a colonel, even though he had retired after the war as a lieutenant colonel. He had recently petitioned the British War Office to approve the change in rank, since he was returning to South America to raise money, and it is a matter of some importance. In a later plea, he was more explicit. "The higher rank has a certain importance in dealing with local officials, lieutenant colonel not only being locally equivalent to commandante, a grade below colonel, but as a rank having lost much of its local prestige owing to the large number of temporary officers who have retained it." The War Office refused his request on both occasions, but he inflated his rank anyway, a subterfuge he maintained so steadfastly that nearly everyone, including his family and friends, eventually knew him only as Colonel Fawcett. In the presidential palace, Fawcett and Rondon greeted each other cordially. Rondon, who had been promoted to general, was in uniform and wore a gold-braided cap. His graying hair gave him a distinguished look, and he stood ramrod straight. As another English traveler once noted, he commanded instant attention, an atmosphere of conscious dignity and power that immediately singled him out. Aside from the president, there was no one else in the room. According to Rondon, Fawcett gradually made his case for Xi, emphasizing the importance of his archaeological research for Brazil. The president seemed sympathetic and asked Rondon what he thought of this valuable project. Rondon suspected that his rival, who remained secretive about his route, might have some ulterior motive, perhaps to exploit the jungle's mineral wealth for England. There were also rumors, later fanned by the Russians on Radio Moscow, that Fawcett was still a spy, though there was no evidence for this. Rondon insisted that it was not necessary for foreigners to conduct expeditions in Brazil, as we have civilians and military men who are very capable of doing such work. The president noted that he had promised the British ambassador that he would help. Rondon said that it was imperative, then, that the search for Xi involve a joint Brazilian-British expedition. Fawcett was convinced that Rondon was trying to sabotage him, and his temper grew. "I intend to go alone," he snapped. The two explorers faced each other down. The president initially sided with his countrymen and said that the expedition should include Rondon's men. But economic difficulties prompted the Brazilian government to withdraw from the expedition, though it gave Fawcett enough money to launch a bare-bones operation. Before Fawcett left their final meeting, Rondon told him, "I pray for the colonel's good fortune." Fawcett had enlisted for the expedition a British Army officer and RGS member whom Reeves had recommended, but at the last minute the officer backed out. Undeterred, Fawcett posted an advertisement in newspapers and recruited a 6-foot-5-inch Australian boxer named Lewis Brown and a 31-year-old American ornithologist, Ernest Holt. Brown was the wild sort drawn to the frontier, and before leaving on the expedition, he indulged his sexual appetites. "I'm flesh and blood like the rest," he told Fawcett. Holt, in contrast, was a sensitive young man who, growing up in Alabama, had collected lizards and snakes and had long aspired to be a naturalist explorer in the mold of Darwin. Like Fawcett, he wrote down poems in his diary to recite in the jungle, including Kipling's words, "The dreamer whose dream came true." Holt also printed on his diary's cover, in bold letters, a relative's address, in case of fatal accident. The three gathered in Cuiabá, the capital of Mato Grosso. During the 6 years Fawcett had been away from the Amazon, the rubber boom had collapsed, and a central role in its demise was played by a former president of the Royal Geographical Society, Sir Clements Markham. In the 1870s, Markham had engineered the smuggling of Amazonian rubber tree seeds to Europe, which were then distributed to plantations throughout British colonies in Asia. Compared with the brutal, inefficient, and costly extraction of wild rubber in the jungle, growing rubber on Asian plantations was easy and cheap, and the produce abundant. "The electric lights went out in Manaus," the historian Robin Furneaux wrote. "The opera house was silent, and the jewels which had filled it were gone. Vampire bats circled the chandeliers of the broken palaces, and spiders scurried across their floors." Fawcett described Cuiabá as impoverished and backward, a place that had degenerated into little better than a ghost town. The streets were covered in mud and grass. Only the main road was illuminated by electric light bulbs. As Fawcett gathered provisions for his expedition, he feared that he was being spied on. In fact, General Rondon had vowed not to let the Englishman out of his sight until he discovered his true intentions. In his correspondence, Fawcett began to use a cipher to conceal his route. As Nina explained in a letter to a trusted friend, "Lat X plus 4 to X plus 5, and Longe Y plus 2, where X is twice the number of letters in the name of the town where he stayed with us, and Y is the number of the building in London where I used to visit him. She added, "Keep the key to this cipher entirely to yourself." Fawcett received a farewell note from his son Jack, who wrote that he had had a dream in which he entered an ancient temple in a city like Z. "May protection be with you at all stages of your journey," Jack told his father, and wished him Godspeed. Fawcett asked a local intermediary that if his family or friends get alarmed at no news, please soothe them with the confident assertion, "We shall come to no untoward end, and shall be heard of in due course." And in a letter to Kelty, he vowed, "I am going to reach this place and return from it." Trailed by his two companions, plus two horses, two oxen, and a pair of dogs, he then marched northward toward the Xingu River, holding his machete like a knight clutching his sword. Soon after, everything began to unravel. Rains flooded their path and destroyed their equipment. Brown, despite his ferocious appearance, suffered a mental breakdown, and Fawcett, fearing another Murray-like disaster, dispatched him back to Cuyaba. Holt, too, grew feeble. He said that it was impossible to do field work because of the horrific conditions, and he maniacally catalogued the bugs that were attacking him until his diary contained details of almost nothing else. "More than half ill from insects," he scribbled, adding, "Days of toil, nights of torture, an explorer's life. Where is the romance now?" Fawcett was irate. "How could he get anywhere with this cripple?" he wrote in his journals. Yet Fawcett, too, was at the age of 53, no longer immune to the forces of nature. His leg had become swollen and infected, "giving me so much pain at night that sleep was difficult," he confessed in his diary. One night, he took opium pills and became violently ill. "It was rather unusual for me to be laid low in this way, and I was heartily ashamed of myself," he wrote. A month into their journey, the animals started to collapse. "It is awful on one's nerves to watch one's pack animals slowly dying," Holt wrote. An ox that had been invaded by maggots lay down and never got up. One of the dogs was starving, and Holt shot it. A horse drowned. Then the other horse dropped in its tracks, and Fawcett put it out of its misery with a bullet. This was the site that became known as Dead Horse Camp. Finally, Holt prostrated himself and said, "Never mind me, Colonel. You go on. Just leave me here." Fawcett knew the expedition might be his last opportunity to prove the theory of Z, and he cursed the gods for conspiring against him, decried them for the weather, his companions, and the war that had held him back. Fawcett realized that if he left Holt behind, he would die. "There was nothing for it," Fawcett later wrote, "but to take him back and give up the present trip as a failure. A sickening, heart-rending failure." What he would not admit was that his own infected leg made proceeding almost impossible. As the expedition party struggled back to the nearest frontier outpost, enduring 36 hours without water, Fawcett told Holt, "The exit from hell is always difficult." When they emerged in Cuyaba in January 1921, Ambassador Paget sent a telegram to Nina saying only, "Your husband returned." Nina asked Harold Large, "What does it mean, think you? Not failure, I should say. Possibly he may not have found the lost cities, but I should think he's found something important, or surely he wouldn't have returned." Yet he had returned with nothing. General Rondon released a gloating statement to the press that said, "Colonel Fawcett's expedition was abandoned, in spite of all his pride as an explorer. He came back thin, naturally disappointed for having been forced to retreat before entering the hardest part of the Xingu." Devastated, Fawcett made plans to return to the jungle with Holt, who was still under contract and whose services were all he could afford. The wife of the American vice consul in Rio, who was a friend of the ornithologists, sent Holt a letter beseeching him not to go. "You are a strong, able-bodied young man. So why do you deliberately throw your life away, as you will if you go back to Mato Grosso?" We all realize that you are deeply interested in and love science, but how much good is it going to do you or the world to have you go aimlessly into the depths of nowhere? What about your mother and sister? Don't they count for anything? Someday one or both of them may need you, and where will you be? You have no right to sacrifice your life just because a man you do not know wants you to. Many lives are lost for the betterment of mankind, it is true. But how is this wild goose chase to help or give anything to the world? Still, Holt was determined to see the expedition through and went to Rio to collect supplies. Fawcett, meanwhile, was turning over in his mind every aspect of Holt's performance, each complaint, each misstep, each error. He even began to suspect, though he had no evidence, that Holt was a Judas, sending information back to Dr. Rice or another rival. Fawcett dispatched a message to Holt that said, "Unfortunately, we live and think in different worlds and can no more mix than oil and water. And as the objects of this journey with me come first and personal considerations last, I prefer to finish it alone than to risk results unnecessarily." Holt, dumbfounded, wrote in his diary, "After close association with Colonel Fawcett for a period covering 1 year, I find that the lesson most clearly impressed upon my mind is, never again, under any circumstances, form any connection with any Englishman whatsoever." He lamented that, instead of earning fame, he remained a vagabond ornithologist, or perhaps tramp bird skinner would be nearer a true title. He concluded, "As far as my biased observation goes, Fawcett possesses only three qualities that I admire: nerve, kindness to animals, and quick forgetfulness of a row." Fawcett told a friend that he had fired another expedition companion, who was convinced, I am sure, that I am a lunatic. Now, for the first time, the thought began to take hold. If only my son could come. Jack was strong and devoted. He would not complain like a pink-eyed weakling. He would not demand a large salary or mutiny. And most important, he believed in Z. "I longed for the day when my son would be old enough to work with me," Fawcett wrote. For the moment, though, Jack, still only 18, was not ready, and Fawcett had no one. The logical choice was to postpone the journey, but instead he sold half his military pension to pay for provisions, gambling what little private savings he had, and came up with a new plan. This time, he would try to reach Z from the opposite direction, heading from east to west, starting in Bahia and passing where he thought the Bandeira Ranch had discovered the city in 1753. He would walk hundreds of miles inland toward the jungle in Mato Grosso. The plan seemed mad. Even Fawcett conceded to Kelty that if he went alone, the prospects of returning are diminished. Nevertheless, in August of 1921, he set out, unaccompanied. "Loneliness is not intolerable when enthusiasm for a quest fills the mind," he wrote. Thirsty and hungry, delirious and deranged, he marched on and on. At one point, he looked out at cliffs in the distant horizon and thought he saw the shapes of a city, or was his mind unraveling? His supplies were exhausted, his legs spent. After 3 months in the wilderness and facing death, he had no choice but to retreat. "I must return," he vowed. "I shall return." Chapter 18. A Scientific Obsession. "It's up to you, Jack," Fawcett said. The two were talking after Fawcett had come back from his 1921 expedition. While Fawcett had been away, Nina had moved the family from Jamaica to Los Angeles, where the Rimels had also gone and where Jack and Raleigh had been swept up in the romance of Hollywood, greasing their hair, growing Clark Gable mustaches, and hanging around Hollywood sets in the hopes of landing roles. Jack had met Mary Pickford and loaned her his cricket bat to use in the production of Little Lord Fauntleroy. Fawcett had a proposition for his son. Colonel T.E. Lawrence, the celebrated desert spy and explorer, better known as Lawrence of Arabia, had volunteered to go with Fawcett on his next journey in search of Z. But Fawcett was wary of choosing a companion with a powerful ego who was unaccustomed to the Amazon. As Fawcett wrote to a friend, "Lawrence may be keen upon South American exploration, but in the first place he probably requires a salary I cannot pay him, and in the second place, excellent work in the Near East does not infer the ability or willingness to hump a 60-pound pack, live for a year upon the forest, suffer from legions of insects, and accept the conditions which I would impose." Fawcett told Jack that, instead of Lawrence, he could take part in the expedition. It would be one of the most difficult and dangerous expeditions in the history of exploration. The ultimate test, in Fawcett's words, of faith, courage, and determination. Jack didn't hesitate. "I want to go with you," he said. Nina, who was present during these discussions, raised no objections. Partly, she was confident that Fawcett's seemingly superhuman powers would protect their son, and partly, she believed that Jack, as his father's natural heir, would possess similar abilities. Yet her motivation seems to have gone deeper than that. To doubt her husband after so many years of sacrifice was to doubt her own life's work. Indeed, she needed Z just as much as he did. And even though Jack had no exploring experience and the expedition entailed extraordinary danger, she never considered, as she later told a reporter, trying to hold her son back. Of course, Raleigh had to come too. Jack said that he could not do the most important thing in his life without him. Raleigh's mother, Elsie, was reluctant to permit her youngest son, her boy, as she called him, to join such a dangerous venture. But Raleigh was insistent. His movie aspirations had foundered, and he was toiling in menial jobs in the lumber industry. As he told his older brother, Roger, he felt unsatisfied and unsettled. This was his opportunity not only to earn a pile of dough, but also to make good with his life. Fawcett informed the RGS and others that he now had two ideal companions, both strong as horses and keen as mustard, and tried once more to secure funding. "I can only say I am a founder's medalist, and therefore deserving of confidence," he maintained. Yet the failure of his previous expedition, even though it was only the first in an illustrious career, had given his critics further ammunition. And with no backers, and after exhausting what little savings he had on his previous expedition, he soon found himself bankrupt, like his father. In September 1921, unable to sustain the cost of living in California, he was forced to uproot his family again and return to Stoke Cannon, England, where he rented an old ramshackle house without running water or electricity. "All water has to be pumped, and huge logs have to be sawn into blocks, all additional labor," Nina wrote to Large. The work was grueling. "I broke down utterly about 5 weeks ago and was very seriously ill," Nina said. Part of her wanted to run away and escape all the sacrifices and burdens, but, she said, "the family needed me." "The situation is difficult," Fawcett admitted to Large. "One learns little from a smooth life, but I do not like roping others into the difficulties which have dogged me so persistently. It is not that I want luxuries. I care little about such things. But I hate inactivity." He couldn't afford to send Jack to university, and Brian and Joan stopped attending school in order to help with chores and do odd jobs to make money. They hawked photographs and paintings, while Fawcett sold off family possessions and heirlooms. "My man actually suggested a few days ago that he thought it would be a wise thing to sell those old Spanish chairs if they would fetch a good price," Nina wrote Large. By 1923, Fawcett had become so poor that he could not pay his annual £3 membership dues to the RGS. "I wish you would give me the benefit of your advice as to whether I could resign without something in the nature of a scandal for a founder's medalist," Fawcett wrote Kelty. "The fact is that the forced inertia and family going to California have left me on the rocks. I had hoped to weather them, but such hopes seem to wilt away, and I do not think I can hang on." He added, It is rather a fall from dreams. Although he scraped up enough money to pay for another year of dues, Nina was concerned about her husband. PHF was in the lowest depths of despair, she confided to Large. My father's impatience to start off on his last trip was tearing at him with ever-increasing force, Brian later recalled. From reticent, he became almost surly. Fawcett began to lash out at the scientific establishment, which he felt had turned its back on him. He told a friend, "Archaeological and ethnological science is founded upon the sands of speculation, and we know what may happen to houses so constructed." He denounced his enemies at the RGS and detected treachery everywhere. He complained about the money wasted on these useless Antarctic expeditions, about the men of science who had, in their day, pooh-poohed the existence of the Americas, and later the idea of Herculaneum, Pompeii, and Troy. About how all the skepticism in Christendom won't budge me an inch from believing in Z. About how he was going to see it through somehow or other, even if I have to wait another decade. He increasingly surrounded himself with spiritualists who not only confirmed but embroidered on his own vision of Z. One seer told him, "The valley and city are full of jewels, spiritual jewels, but also immense wealth of real jewels." Fawcett published essays in journals, such as the Occult Review, in which he spoke of his spiritual quest and the treasures of the invisible world. Another South American explorer and RGS fellow said that many people thought that Fawcett had become a trifle unbalanced. Some called him a scientific maniac. In the spiritualist magazine Light, Fawcett contributed an essay titled Obsession. Without mentioning his own idée fixe, he described how mental storms could consume a person with fearful torture. "Undoubtedly, obsession is the diagnosis of many cases of madness," he concluded. Brooding day and night, Fawcett hatched various half-baked schemes to mine nitrate in Brazil, to prospect for oil in California, in order to raise money for his expedition. The mining syndicate fell through, because it was a nest of crooks, Fawcett wrote Large in October 1923. Jack told another family friend, "It seemed as if some evil genius was trying to put every possible obstacle in our way." Still, Jack continued to train in case the money suddenly came through. Without Raleigh's lighthearted influence, he adopted his father's asceticism, shunning meat and liquor. "A short time ago, I had the idea that I must set myself a certain immensely difficult trial requiring a tremendous spiritual effort," he wrote Esther Windust, a family friend who was a theosophist. "By great effort, I have been successful and have already felt the benefit." He added, "I enjoy immensely the life and teachings of Buddha, which came somewhat as a surprise to me in their absolute adherence to my own ideas." You notice his dislike of creeds and dogma. A visitor to the house was struck by Jack's presence. "The capacity for love and the slight ascetic restraint makes one think of the Knights of the Grail." Fawcett, meanwhile, tried to hold out faith that sooner or later the gods will accept me for service. At one point, his friend Ryder Haggard told Fawcett that he had something important he wanted to give the explorer. It was a stone idol, about 10 inches tall, with almond-shaped eyes and hieroglyphics carved on its chest. Haggard, who had kept it by his desk while writing the 1919 book When the World Shook, said that he had received the statue from someone in Brazil who believed it came from the Indians in the interior. Fawcett took the idol with him and had it examined by several museum experts. Most suspected it was a fake. But Fawcett, in his desperation, even showed it to a psychic and concluded that it might be a relic of Z. In the spring of 1924, Fawcett learned that Dr. Rice, drawing on his bottomless bank account, was mounting one of the most extraordinary expeditions ever assembled. He had compiled a team that reflected the new demand for specialization. It included experts in botany, zoology, topography, astronomy, geography, and medicine, as well as one of the world's most distinguished anthropologists, Dr. Theodore Koch Grünberg and Silvino Santos, considered the first cinematographer of the Amazon. More breathtaking was the expedition's arsenal of equipment. There was the Eleanor II, along with another elegant vessel, and a new wireless radio system, this one able not only to receive signals, but also to send them. These objects, however, were not what had created the greatest stir. As the New York Times reported, the doctor had with him a 160-horsepower, six-cylinder, three-person oak-propeller hydroplane with a complete outfit of aerial cameras. Fawcett believed that Dr. Rice's equipment had limitations in the Amazon. Existing radios were so bulky that they would confine the expedition to boats, and aerial observation and photography would not necessarily be able to penetrate the canopy. There was also the risk of landing a plane in hostile areas. The Times reported that the doctor's hydroplane was loaded with a supply of bombs to be used in scaring the cannibal Indians, a tactic that horrified Fawcett. Nevertheless, Fawcett knew that an airplane could carry even the most inept explorer to extreme places. Dr. Rice proclaimed that the whole method of exploration and geographical mapping will be revolutionized. The expedition, or at least the film that Santos planned to shoot, was called No Rastro do El Dorado, or On the Trail of El Dorado. Although Fawcett believed that his rival was still searching too far north for Z, he was petrified. That September, while Rice and his team were making their way into the Amazon, Fawcett met a swashbuckling British war correspondent and one-time member of the RGS named George Lynch. Well-connected in both the United States and Europe, he frequented the Savage Club in London, where writers and artists would gather over drinks and cigars. Fawcett found Lynch, who was 56, to be a highly respectable man of unimpeachable character and excellent repute. What's more, Lynch was enthralled by the idea of finding Z. In exchange for a percentage of the profits that would arise from the expedition, Lynch, who was a far more capable salesman than Fawcett, offered to help raise money. Fawcett had focused most of his fundraising efforts on the financially strapped RGS. Now, with Lynch's assistance, he would look for support from the United States, that bustling new empire that was constantly expanding into new frontiers and was awash in capital. On October 28, Jack wrote Windus to say that Lynch had left for America to get in touch with millionaires. Realizing the power of Fawcett's legend and the commercial value of his story, the finest exploration story that I think has ever been written in our time, as Fawcett put it, Lynch initially mined his contacts in the media. Within days, he had secured thousands of dollars by selling the story rights for Fawcett's expedition to the North American Newspaper Alliance, or NANA, a consortium of publications that had a presence in almost every major city in the United States and Canada. The consortium, which included the New York World, the Los Angeles Times, the Houston Chronicle, the Times-Picayune, and the Toronto Star, was known for giving press credentials to non-professional reporters who could provide gripping dispatches from the most exotic and dangerous locales. The consortium later enlisted Ernest Hemingway as a foreign correspondent during the Spanish Civil War and funded expeditions like Thor Heyerdahl's 1947 crossing of the Pacific by raft. While explorers had typically written about their adventures after the fact, Fawcett would send Indian runners out with dispatches during his journey, even, if possible, from the Forbidden City itself, as one newspaper reported. Lynch also sold the rights to Fawcett's expedition to newspapers throughout the world, so that tens of millions of people on virtually every continent would read about his journey. Though Fawcett was wary of trivializing his scientific endeavors with journalese, as he called it, he was grateful for any funding, not to mention the assured burst of glory. What made him most happy, though, was a cable from Lynch informing him that his proposal was generating equal enthusiasm among prestigious American scientific institutions. Not only did these foundations have more money than many of their European counterparts, but they were also more open to Fawcett's theory. The director of the American Geographical Society, Dr. Isaiah Bowman, had been a member of Hiram Bingham's expedition that discovered Machu Picchu, which scientists at the time had never expected to be found. Dr. Bowman told a reporter, "We have known of Colonel Fawcett for many years as a man of soundest character and the highest integrity. We have the highest confidence both in his capacity and in his competence and reliability as a scientist." The American Geographical Society offered the expedition a $1,000 grant. The Museum of the American Indian followed with another $1,000. On November 4, 1924, Fawcett wrote Kelty saying, "I judge from Lynch's cable and letters that the whole affair is catching the fancy of Americans.